The World War was man-made and destructive. Nature planted in the circumstances of the war the seed of an equivalent reprimand in the form of a world depression. The depression was inevitable and inescapable. It followed the war as naturally as day follows night, and by the operation of the selfsame law, the law of hypnotic rhythm.
Am I to understand that the law of hypnotic rhythm is the same as that which Ralph Waldo Emerson called the law of compensation?
The law of hypnotic rhythm is the law of compensation. It is the power with which nature balances negative and positive forces throughout the universes, in all forms of energy, in all forms of matter, and in all human relationships.
Does the law of hypnotic rhythm operate quickly in all instances? For example, does this law immediately bless one with the benefits of positive application of thoughts, or curse one immediately with the results of negative thoughts?
The law operates definitely, but not always swiftly. Both the benefits and the penalties incurred through the law by individuals may be harvested by others, either before or after their death. Observe how this law works by forcing upon one generation of people the effects of both the sins and the virtues of preceding generations. In the operation of all of nature's laws, the fourth dimension, time, is an inexorable factor. The length of time consumed by nature in the relation of effects to their causes depends in every instance on the circumstances at hand. Nature grows a pumpkin in 3 months. A good-sized oak tree requires 100 years. She converts a hen's egg into a chicken in 4 weeks, but she requires 9 months to convert the egg of a human being into an individual.
Life gives no one immunity against adversity, but life gives to everyone the power of positive thought, which is sufficient to master all circumstances of adversity and convert them into benefits. Has nature created the current economic turmoil to allow us once again to convert our own personal adversities into benefits?
Chapter 12. Environment, Time, Harmony, and Caution. I now have a better understanding of the potentialities of adversity and failure. You may go ahead now with your description of the next of the 7 principles. What is your next principle?
The next principle is environmental influence.
Go ahead and describe the working principle of environmental influences as a determining factor in human destinies.
Environment consists of all the mental, spiritual, and physical forces which affect and influence human beings.
What connection, if any, is there between environmental influences and hypnotic rhythm?
Hypnotic rhythm solidifies and makes permanent the thought habits of human beings. Thought habits are stimulated by environmental influences. In other words, the material on which thoughts are fed comes from one's environment. Thought habits are made permanent by hypnotic rhythm.
What is the most important part of one's environment, the part which determines, more than all others, whether an individual makes positive or negative use of his mind?
The most important part of one's environment is that created by his association with others. All people absorb and take over, either consciously or unconsciously, the thought habits of those with whom they associate closely.
Do you mean by this that constant association with a person whose thought habits are negative influences one to form negative thought habits?
Yes. The law of hypnotic rhythm forces every human being to form thought habits which harmonize with the dominating influences of his environment, particularly that part of his environment created by his association with other minds.
Then it is important that one select one's close associates with great care.
Yes. One's intimate associate should be chosen with as much care as one chooses the food with which he feeds his body, with the object always of associating with people whose dominating thoughts are positive, friendly, and harmonious.
Which class of associates has the greatest influence upon one?
One's partner in marriage and in the home, and one's associates in his occupation. After that come close friends and acquaintances. Casual acquaintances and strangers have but little influence on one.
The material on which thoughts are fed come from one's environment. Thought habits are made permanent by hypnotic rhythm. Have you ever felt your attitude or mood become negative just by being in the presence of someone negative? Was it your spouse, child, or business partner? Hill suggests that you need to interject thoughts that are positive, friendly, and harmonious, not only to counteract those negative thoughts, but also to influence that person into a more positive space. If it is your business partner, evaluate if the relationship is one you want to save, or make the decision to move away from the partner's negativity.
Why does one's partner in marriage have so great an influence upon one's mind?
Because the relationship of marriage brings people under the influence of spiritual forces of such weight that they become dominating forces of the mind.
How may environmental influences be used to break the grip of hypnotic rhythm?
All influences which establish thought habits are given permanency through the law of hypnotic rhythm. One may change the influences of his environment so that the dominating influences are either positive or negative, and the law of hypnotic rhythm will make them permanent unless they are changed through one's habits of thought.
Stating this truth in another way, one may submit himself to any environmental influence desired, whether positive or negative, and the law of hypnotic rhythm will make the influence permanent when it assumes the magnitude of thought habit. Is that the way the law works?
That is correct. Be careful of all forces which inspire thought. Those are the forces which constitute environment and determine the nature of one's earthly destiny.
What class of people controls their environmental influences?
The non-drifters. All who are victims of the habit of drifting forfeit their power to choose their own environment. They become the victims of every negative influence of their environment.
Is there no way out for the drifter? Is there no method by which he may submit himself to the influence of a positive environment?
Yes, there is a way out for drifters. They can stop drifting, take possession of their own minds, and choose an environment which inspires positive thought. This they may accomplish through definiteness of purpose.
Is that all there is to the act of eliminating the habit of drifting? Is the habit only a state of mind?
Drifting is nothing but a negative state of mind, a state of mind conspicuous by its emptiness of purpose.
What effective procedure may one follow in establishing an environment most helpful in developing and maintaining positive thought habits?
The most effective of all environments is that which may be created by a friendly alliance of a group of people who will obligate themselves to assist one another in achieving the object of some definite purpose. This sort of an alliance is known as a mastermind. Through its operation, one may associate himself with carefully chosen individuals, each of whom brings to the alliance some knowledge, experience, education, plan, or idea suited to his needs in carrying out the object of his definite purpose. The most successful leaders in all walks of life avail themselves of this sort of made-to-order environmental influence. Outstanding achievement is impossible without the friendly cooperation of others. Stating the truth in another way, successful people must control their environment, thereby insuring themselves against the influence of a negative environment.
What of people whose duty to relatives makes it impossible for them to avoid the influence of a negative environment?
No human being owes another any degree of duty which robs him of his privilege of building his thought habits in a positive environment. On the other hand, every human being is duty-bound to himself to remove from his environment every influence which even remotely tends to develop negative thought habits.
Isn't this a cold-blooded philosophy?
Only the strong survive. No one can be strong without removing himself from all influences which develop negative thought habits. Negative thought habits result in the loss of the privilege of self-determination, no matter what or who may cause those habits. Positive thought habits may be controlled by the individual and made to serve his aims and purposes. Negative thought habits control the individual and deprive him of the privilege of self-determination.
I deduce from all you have said that those who control the environmental influences out of which their thought habits are built are masters of their earthly destinies, and that all others are mastered by earthly destinies. Is that stating the matter correctly?
Perfectly stated.
What establishes one's thought habits?
All habits are established because of inherent or acquired desires, or motives. That is, habits are begun as the result of some form of definite desire.
What takes place in the physical brain while one is forming thought habits?
Desires are organized impulses of energy, called thoughts. Desires that are mixed with emotional feeling magnetize the brain cells in which they are stored and prepare those cells to be taken over and directed by the law of hypnotic rhythm. When any thought appears in the brain or is created there, and is mixed with keen emotional feeling of desire, the law of hypnotic rhythm begins at once to translate it into its physical counterpart. Dominating thoughts, which are acted upon first by the law of hypnotic rhythm, are those with which are mixed the strongest desires and the most intense feelings. Thought habits are established by the repetition of the same thoughts.
What are the most impelling basic motives or desires which inspire thought action?
The 10 most common motives, those which inspire most of one's physical action, are these. The desire for sex expression and love, the desire for physical food, the desire for spiritual, mental, and physical self-expression, the desire for perpetuation of life after death, the desire for power over others, the desire for material wealth, the desire for knowledge, the desire to imitate others, the desire to excel others, the 7 basic fears. These are the dominating motives which inspire the majority of all human endeavors.
What about the negative desires, such as greed, envy, avarice, jealousy, anger? Are these not expressed more often than any of the positive desires?
All negative desires are nothing but frustrations of positive desires. They are inspired by some form of defeat, failure, or neglect by human beings to adapt themselves to nature's laws in a positive way.
That's a new slant on the subject of negative thoughts. If I correctly understand what you have said, all negative thoughts are inspired by one's neglect or failure to adapt oneself harmoniously to nature's laws. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. Nature will not tolerate idleness or vacuums of any sort. All space must be and is filled with something. Everything in existence, of both a physical and a spiritual nature, must be and is constantly in motion. The human brain is no exception. It was created to receive, organize, specialize, and express the power of thought. When the individual does not use the brain for the expression of positive, creative thoughts, nature fills the vacuum by forcing the brain to act upon negative thoughts. There can be no idleness in the brain. Understand this principle, and you will come into a new and important understanding of the part environmental influences take in the lives of human beings. You will better understand also how the law of hypnotic rhythm operates, it being the law which keeps everything and everyone constantly moving through some form of expression of either negative or positive principles. Nature is not interested in morals as such. She is not interested in right and wrong. She is not interested in justice and injustice. She is interested only in forcing everything to express action according to its nature.
Nature will not tolerate idleness or vacuums of any sort. All space must be and is filled with something. When the individual does not use the brain for the expression of positive, creative thoughts, nature fills the vacuum by forcing the brain to act upon negative thoughts. I find this so true, particularly when I think of children who have too much idle time on their hands. Don Green, CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation, remembers, "As young people, we were constantly kept busy with the admonition that idleness was the devil's workshop." Interesting parallel, don't you think?
That is an enlightening interpretation of nature's ways. To whom may I turn for corroboration of your claims?
To men of science, to the philosophers, to all accurate thinkers. Lastly, to the physical manifestations of nature herself. Nature has no such thing as dead matter. Every atom of matter is constantly in a state of motion. All energy is constantly in motion. There are no dead voids anywhere. Time and space are literally manifestations of motion of such swiftness that it cannot be measured by human beings.
Alas, one is forced to the conclusion, from what you say, that the sources of dependable knowledge are shockingly limited.
The developed sources of knowledge are limited. Every normal adult human brain is a potential gateway to all the knowledge there is throughout the universes. Every normal adult brain has within its mechanism the possibility of direct communication with infinite intelligence, wherein exists all the knowledge that is or can ever be.
Your statement leads me to believe that human beings may become all they have attributed to what they call God. Is that what you mean?
Through the law of evolution, the human brain is being perfected to communicate at will with infinite intelligence. The perfection will come through organized development of the brain, through its adaptation to nature's laws. Time is the factor which will bring perfection.
What causes cycles of recurring events such as epidemics of disease, business depressions, wars, and crime waves?
All such epidemics in which great numbers of people are similarly affected are caused by the law of hypnotic rhythm, through which nature consolidates thoughts of a similar nature and causes those thoughts to be expressed through mass action.
Then the Great Depression was put into motion because great numbers of people were influenced to release thoughts of fear. Is that correct?
Perfectly. Millions of people were endeavoring to get something for nothing through stock gambling. When they suddenly discovered they had gotten nothing for something, they became frightened, rushed to their banks to draw out their balances, and the panic was on. Through mass thought of millions of minds, all thinking in terms of fear of poverty, the depression was prolonged over a period of years.
The current economic turmoil in the United States and throughout the world was put into motion in a similar fashion. Millions were endeavoring to get something for nothing through real estate, no-money-down deals, subprime mortgages, and valuation bubbles, as well as the financial markets. When everything started to collapse, they became frightened, and the panic was on once again. By changing the thoughts of these millions from fear back to focus on fundamentally sound financial principles, can we stabilize the economy? Napoleon Hill's philosophy can show us the way. The choice is ours.
From what you say, I deduce that nature consolidates the dominating thoughts of people and expresses these thoughts through some form of mass action, such as business depressions, business booms, and so on. Is that correct?
You have the right idea.
Let us now take up the next of the seven principles. Go ahead and describe it.
The next principle is time, the fourth dimension.
What relationship is there between time and the operation of the law of hypnotic rhythm?
Time is the law of hypnotic rhythm. The lapse of time required to give permanency to thought habits depends upon the object and the nature of the thoughts.
But I understood you to say that the only enduring thing in nature is change. If that is true, then time is constantly changing, rearranging, and recombining all things, including one's thought habits. How, then, could the law of hypnotic rhythm give permanency to one's thought habits?
Time divides all thought habits into two classes, negative thoughts and positive thoughts. One's individual thoughts are, of course, constantly changing and being recombined to suit the individual's desires. But thoughts do not change from negative to positive, or vice versa, except through voluntary effort on the part of the individual. Time penalizes the individual for all negative thoughts and rewards him for all positive thoughts, according to the nature and purpose of the thoughts. If one's dominating thoughts are negative, time penalizes the individual by building in his mind the habit of negative thinking, and then proceeds to solidify this habit into permanency every second of its existence. Positive thoughts are, likewise, woven by time into permanent habits. The term permanency, of course, refers to the natural life of the individual. In the strict sense of the term, nothing is permanent. Time converts thought habits into what might be called permanency during the life of the individual.
Now I have a better understanding of how time works. What other characteristics has time in connection with the earthly destiny of human beings?
Time is nature's seasoning influence through which human experience may be ripened into wisdom. People are not born with wisdom, but they are born with the capacity to think, and they may, through the lapse of time, think their way into wisdom.
People are not born with wisdom, but they are born with the capacity to think, and they may, through the lapse of time, think their way into wisdom. I find this one of the most profound statements in the entire book. By using our ability to think and analyzing our experiences in life, whether successes or failures, we can gain wisdom. Can it actually be that simple?
Do youths ever possess wisdom?
Only in very elementary matters. Wisdom comes only through the lapse of time. It cannot be inherited, and it cannot be imparted from one person to another except through the lapse of time.
Does the lapse of time force an individual to acquire wisdom?
No. Wisdom comes only to non-drifters who form positive thought habits as a dominating force in their lives. Drifters and those whose dominating thoughts are negative never acquire wisdom, except of a very elementary nature.
From what you say, I infer that time is the friend of the person who trains his mind to follow positive thought habits and the enemy of the person who drifts into negative thought habits. Is that correct?
That is precisely true. All people can be classified as drifters and non-drifters. Drifters are always at the mercy of the non-drifters, and time makes this relationship permanent.
Do you mean that if I drift along through life without definite aim or purpose, the non-drifter may become my master, and time only serves to give the non-drifter a stronger and more permanent grip upon me?
That is stating the truth exactly.
Wisdom comes only to non-drifters who form positive thought habits as a dominating force in their lives. Again, I am forced to think about our children. With so much negativity around us due to terrorism and financial strife, what is going to be the long-term impact on our children? We must envelop our children in positive experiences in order to generate positive thoughts in their minds.
What is wisdom?
Wisdom is the ability to relate yourself to nature's laws so as to make them serve you, and the ability to relate yourself to other people so as to gain their harmonious, willing cooperation in helping you to make life yield whatever you demand of it.
Then accumulated knowledge is not wisdom.
Great heavens, no! If knowledge were wisdom, the achievements of science would not have been converted into implements of destruction.
What is needed to convert knowledge into wisdom?
Time, plus the desire for wisdom. Wisdom is never thrust upon one. It is acquired, if at all, by positive thinking, through voluntary effort.
Is it safe for all people to have knowledge?
It is never safe for anyone to have extensive knowledge without wisdom.
What is the age at which most people who acquire wisdom begin to acquire it?
The majority of people who acquire wisdom do so after they have passed the age of 40. Prior to that time, the majority of people are too busy gathering knowledge and organizing it into plans to spend any effort seeking wisdom.
What circumstance of life is most apt to lead one to acquire wisdom?
Adversity and failure. These are nature's universal languages through which she imparts wisdom to those who are ready to receive it.
Do adversity and failure always bring wisdom?
No, only to those who are ready for wisdom and have voluntarily sought it.
What determines one's readiness to receive wisdom?
Time and the nature of one's thought habits.
Is newly acquired knowledge the same as time-tested knowledge?
No. Knowledge tested through the lapse of time always is superior to that which has been newly acquired. Time gives to knowledge definiteness in both quality and quantity, and dependability. One can never be sure of knowledge that has not been tested.
What is dependable knowledge?
It is knowledge which harmonizes with natural law, which means that it is based upon positive thought.
Does time modify and alter the values of knowledge?
Yes, time modifies and alters all values. That which is accurate knowledge today may become null and void tomorrow because of time's rearrangement of facts and values. Time modifies all human relationships for better or for worse, depending upon the policy through which people relate themselves to one another. In the realm of thought, there is a time when it is proper to sow the seeds of thought, and there is a proper time to reap the harvest of those thoughts, the same as there is a time to sow and a time to reap from the soil of the earth. Without the proper measurement of time between the sowing and the reaping, nature modifies or withholds the rewards of the sowing.
Go ahead now and describe the last two of the seven principles.
The next principle is harmony. Throughout nature, one may find evidences that all natural law moves in an orderly manner, through the law of harmony. Through the operation of this law, nature forces everything within the range of a given environment to become harmoniously related. Understand this truth, and you will catch a new and a more intriguing vision of the power of environment. You will understand why association with negative minds is fatal to those seeking self-determination.
Do you mean that nature voluntarily forces human beings to harmonize with the influences of their environment?
Yes, that is true. The law of hypnotic rhythm forces upon every living thing the dominating influences of the environment in which it exists.
If nature forces human beings to take on the nature of the environment in which they live, what means of escape are available to people who find themselves in an environment of poverty and failure, but desire to escape?
They must change their environment or remain poverty-stricken. Nature permits no one to escape the influences of his environment. However, nature, in her abundance of wisdom, has given to every normal human being the privilege of establishing his own mental, spiritual, and physical environment. But once he establishes it, he must become a part of it. This is the inexorable working of the law of harmony.
In a business association, for example, who establishes the dominating influence that determines the rhythm of the environment?
The individual or individuals who think and act with definiteness of purpose.
Is it as simple as that?
Yes. Definiteness of purpose is the starting point from which an individual may establish his own environment.
I do not seem to follow your reasoning. The entire world is torn with warfare and business depressions and other forms of strife which represent about everything except harmony. Nature does not seem to be forcing people to harmonize with one another. How do you explain this inconsistency?
There is no inconsistency. The dominating influences of the world are, as you say, negative. Very well, nature is forcing human beings to harmonize with the dominating influences of the world environment.
As in Hill's day, there seems to be little harmony in our world today. When you think of the current economy, the natural disasters, the military conflicts, the human devastation from disease and hunger, does harmony seem even attainable? Hill would say yes, even in the face of the horrible conditions of his time. While you and I may not be in control of harmony in our world, we can create harmony in our homes.
Manifestations of harmony may be either positive or negative. For example, a group of men in prison may, and they generally do, think and act in a negative manner. But nature sees to it that the dominating influence of the prison is impressed upon every individual in it. A group of poverty-stricken people in a tenement house may fight among themselves and apparently resist all forms of harmony. But nature forces each of them to become a part of the dominating influence of the house in which they live. Harmony, in the sense it is here used, means that nature relates everything throughout the universes to every other thing of a similar nature. Negative influences are forced into association with one another, no matter where they may be. Positive influences are just as definitely forced into association with one another.
I'm beginning to see why successful business leaders are so careful in the choice of their business associates. Men who succeed in any calling usually establish their own environment by surrounding themselves with people who think and act in terms of success. Is that the idea?
That is the idea exactly. Observe, with profit, that the one thing all successful men insist upon is harmony among their business associates. Another trait of successful people is that they move with definiteness of purpose and insist upon their associates doing the same. Understand these two truths, and you understand the major difference between a Henry Ford and a day laborer.
So the principle of harmony is a benefit to us when we surround ourselves with other successful people. Think of the people you work with. Are they supporting you or holding you back?
Now, tell me about the last of the seven principles.
The last principle is caution. Next to the habit of drifting, the most dangerous human trait is the lack of caution. People drift into all sorts of hazardous circumstances because they do not exercise caution by planning the moves they make. The drifter always moves without exercising caution. He acts first and thinks later, if at all. He does not choose his friends. He drifts along and allows people to attach themselves to him on their own terms. He does not choose an occupation. He drifts through school and is glad to get the first job that will give him food and clothing. He invites people to cheat him at trade by neglecting to inform himself of the rules of trade. He invites illness by neglecting to inform himself of the rules of sound health. He invites poverty by neglecting to protect himself against the environmental influences of the poverty-stricken. He invites failure at every step he takes by neglecting to exercise the caution to observe what causes people to fail. He invites fear in all its forms by his lack of caution in examining the causes of fear. He fails in marriage because he neglects to use caution in his choice of a mate, and he uses still less caution in his methods of relating himself to her after marriage. He loses his friends or converts them into enemies by his lack of caution in relating himself to them on the proper basis.
Are all people lacking in caution?
No, only those who have acquired the habit of drifting. The non-drifter always uses caution. He carefully thinks his plans through before he begins them. He makes allowances for the human frailties of his associates and plans ahead to bridge them. If he sends a messenger on an important mission, he sends someone else to make sure the messenger does not neglect his mission. Then he checks on both of them to be sure his wishes have been fulfilled. He takes nothing for granted where caution provides a way to ensure his success.
Isn't overcaution as detrimental as lack of caution?
There is no such thing as overcaution. What you call overcaution is an expression of fear. Fear and caution are two entirely different things.
Don't people mistake fear for overcaution?
Yes, that does sometimes happen. But the majority of people create for themselves far more disastrous hazards by total lack of the habit of caution than by overcaution.
In what way may caution be used most advantageously?
In the selection of one's associates and in one's method of relating oneself to associates. The reason for this is obvious. One's associates constitute the most important part of one's environment, and environmental influences determine whether one forms the habit of drifting or becomes a non-drifter. The person who exercises due caution in the choice of associates never allows himself to be closely associated with any person who does not bring to him, through the association, some definite mental, spiritual, or economic benefit.
Isn't that method of choosing associates selfish?
It is sensible and leads to self-determination. It is the desire of every normal person to find material success and happiness. Nothing contributes more to one's success and happiness than carefully chosen associates. Caution in the selection of associates becomes, therefore, the duty of every person who wishes to become happy and successful. The drifter allows his closest associates to attach themselves to him on their own terms. The non-drifter carefully selects his associates and allows no one to become closely associated with him unless that person contributes some form of helpful influence or bestows some definite benefit.
It never occurred to me that caution in the selection of friends had so definite a bearing on one's success or failure. Do all successful people exercise caution in the selection of all their associates, whether in business, social, or professional relationships?
Without the exercise of caution in the choice of all associates, no one may be certain of success in any calling. On the other hand, lack of exercise of caution brings almost certain defeat in whatever one undertakes.
Do you have a hard time saying no to people? This chapter makes you realize that using caution in selecting your associates and learning to say no more often may speed you on your path to success.
Summary. Three things connected with my interview with the devil interest me most. These three factors interest me because they have been the most important influences in my own life, a fact which any listener of my story can easily discern. The three important factors are the habit of drifting, the law of hypnotic rhythm through which all habits are made permanent, and the element of time. Here is a trio of forces which hold inviolate the destinies of all men. The three take on a new and more important meaning when they are grouped and studied as a combined force. It takes but little imagination and scarcely any understanding of natural laws for one to see that most of the difficulties in which people find themselves are of their own making. Moreover, difficulties seldom are the outgrowth of immediate circumstances. They are generally the climax of a series of circumstances which have been consolidated through the habit of drifting and with the aid of time.
Most of the difficulties in which people find themselves are of their own making. Many people today have a victim mentality, which they use as an excuse to not take responsibility for their own lives.
Samuel Insull did not lose his $4 billion industrial empire as the result of the Depression. He began losing it long before the Depression, when he became the victim of a group of women who flattered him into turning his talents from public utilities to grand opera. If ever a man in a high position in the financial world went down because of the power of drifting, hypnotic rhythm, and time, that man was Samuel Insull. I am writing from accurate knowledge of Mr. Insull and the cause of his troubles dating from the time that I served with him during the World War to the time of his ill-advised attempt to run away from himself.
Samuel Insull moved from England to the United States in 1881 to become the private secretary of Thomas Edison and rose to become president of Chicago Edison Company in 1892. By 1907, he had taken control of Chicago's transit system. By 1912, he was operating several hundred power plants. He vigorously promoted the stock of his holding companies. When they collapsed in 1932, he fled to Europe. Extradited in 1934, he was tried three times for fraud, violation of bankruptcy laws, and embezzlement, but was acquitted each time. Hill gives us an inside look at the other reasons for his collapse and fall from grace. Today, you instantly know the name Edison, but probably do not recognize Insull.
Henry Ford went through the same depression that swept Mr. Insull under, but Ford came out on top without a scratch. Do you want to know the reason? I'll tell you. Ford has the habit of not drifting on any subject. Time is Ford's friend, because he has formed the habit of using it in a positive, constructive manner, with the aid of thoughts of his own making, woven into plans of his own creation. Take any circumstance you wish. measure it with reference to its relationship to the habit of drifting, hypnotic rhythm, and time, and you may ascertain accurately the cause of all success and all failure. Franklin D. Roosevelt went into office with a bang during his first term. He had but one major purpose in mind, and that was very definite. It was to stop the stampede of fear and start people to thinking and talking in terms of business recovery instead of business depression. In carrying out that purpose, there was no drifting. The forces of the entire nation were consolidated and moved as one to help carry out the president's definite purpose. For the first time in the history of America, the newspapers of all political leanings, the churches of all denominations, the people of all races and colors, and the political organizations of all brands united themselves into one stupendous power for the sole purpose of helping the president restore faith and normal business relationships in the country. In a conference held between the president and a group of emergency advisors a few days after he went into office, I asked him what was his major problem. He replied, "It is not a question of majors and minors. We have but one problem, and that is to stop fear and supplant it with faith." Before the end of his first year in office, the president had stopped fear and supplanted it by faith, and the nation was slowly but surely on the way out of the jungle of depression. By the end of his first term, mark well the element of lapse of time, the president had so effectively consolidated the forces of American business and private life that he had an entire nation in back of him, ready, willing, and enthusiastically desirous of following his lead, no matter which way he went. These are facts well known to everyone who reads newspapers or listens to the radio.
Like all of us, Napoleon Hill lived in a political environment that affected everyone. We often think of ourselves as victims of the media or the political system or other outside forces. Hill is showing us how to rise above victimhood, another of the devil's tools, and take responsibility for all our choices.
Then came another presidential election and the opportunity for the people to express their faith in their leader. They expressed it in a landslide without precedent in American politics, and the president went into office a second time with an almost unanimous electorate vote, with only two states meekly dissenting. Now observe how the wheel of life began to reverse itself and turn back in the other direction. The president changed his policy from definiteness of purpose to indefiniteness and drifting. His change of policy split the powerful labor group and turned more than half of it against him. It split the almost solid following he held in both houses of Congress, and more important than all this, it split the American people into pro and anti-groups, with the result that about all the president had left of his original political assets was his million-dollar smile and his ready handshake, obviously not enough to enable him to regain the power he once wielded in American life. Here, then, we have an excellent example of a man who skyrocketed to great power through definiteness of purpose and belly flop to the starting point by his habit of drifting. In both his rise and his fall can be seen clearly the operation of the principles of drifting and non-drifting reaching a climax through the power of hypnotic rhythm and time.
Here, then, we have an excellent example of a man who skyrocketed to great power through definiteness of purpose and belly flopped to the starting point by his habit of drifting. Take a moment to think of other people, in the public eye or in your circle of influence, who achieved great success only to lose it later because of drifting.
All my life, the devil had a dramatic story to tell of his dealings with me. He saw me drift in and out of scores of business opportunities for which many would have given a king's ransom. He saw me drifting in my policy of relating myself to others, particularly in my lack of caution in business dealings. The circumstance which saved me from fatal control of the law of hypnotic rhythm was the definiteness of purpose with which, at long last, I dedicated my entire life to the organization of a philosophy of individual achievement. I drifted at one time or another on all my minor whims and endeavors, but my drifting was offset by my major purpose, which was sufficient to restore my courage and start me once more in the quest of knowledge every time I was defeated in connection with my minor aims. I learned something of the hazardous nature of the habit of drifting while engaged in analyzing more than 25,000 people in connection with the organization of the Law of Success. These analyses showed that only 2 out of every 100 have a definite major aim in life. The other 98 were caught by the habit of drifting. It seems more than a coincidence that my analyses clearly corroborated the devil's claim that he controls 98 out of every 100 people because of their habit of drifting. Looking back over my own career, I can see clearly that I could have avoided the majority of the temporary defeats with which I met if I had been definitely following a plan for the attainment of my major purpose in life. From my experience in having analyzed the problems of more than 5,000 families, I know definitely that the majority of married people who get out of harmony with each other do so because of the accumulation of a great number of little circumstances in their married relationship, which could have been cleared up and disposed of as they arose if there had been a definite policy to do so. They do not live their married life with definiteness of purpose. So the story has gone, all back down the ages. The man with the most definite plan and purpose and the most power rides on to victory. The others scurry for cover and get crushed under the heels of those who are more determined. The answer is not hard to find. There is no use looking toward high heaven for it. For my part, I would prefer to seek the answer from the devil, for he would tell me quickly enough that victory goes to the people who know what they want and are determined to have it. They have mastered the habit of drifting. They have definite policies, definite plans, and definite objectives. Their opposition, which may outnumber them very greatly, has no chance against them, because the opposition has no plan, no purpose, no policy, except that of drifting along, hoping that something may turn up to help them. In those three brief sentences, you have the sum and the substance of the difference between success and failure, power and lack of it. We come now near to the end of our visit through this book. If we were to try to state in one brief sentence the most important part of that which I have tried to convey through the book, it would be something like this. One's dominating desires can be crystallized into their physical equivalents through definiteness of purpose, backed by definiteness of plans, with the aid of nature's law of hypnotic rhythm and time. There you have the positive phase of the philosophy of individual achievement I've tried to describe through this book, brought down to an irreducible minimum of brevity and simplicity. If you expand the philosophy for the purpose of adapting it to the circumstances of life, you find that it is as broad as life itself, that it covers all human relationships, all human thoughts, aims, and desires. So here we are, at the end of the strangest of all the thousands of interviews I have had with the great and the near great, over a period of 50 years of labor in my search for the truths of life that lead to happiness and economic security. How strange indeed that after having had active cooperation from men such as Carnegie, Edison, and Ford, I should have been compelled, finally, to go to the devil for a working knowledge of the greatest of all the principles uncovered in my quest for truth. How strange that I was forced to experience poverty and failure and adversity in 100 forms before being given the privilege of understanding and using a law of nature which softens the thrust of these wicked weapons or wipes them out altogether. But the strangest of all this dramatic experience which life has provided me is the simplicity of the law through which, if I had understood it, I could have transmuted my desires into substantial form without having to undergo so many years of hardship and misery. I find now, at the end of my interview with the devil, that I had been carrying in my own pockets the matches with which the fires of adversity were being touched off. And I find, too, that the water with which those fires were finally extinguished was at my command in great abundance. I searched for the philosopher's lodestone with which failure may be converted into success, only to learn that both success and failure are the results of day-to-day evolutionary forces through which dominating thoughts are pieced together bit by bit and woven into the things we want or the things we do not want, according to the nature of those thoughts. How unfortunate that I did not understand this truth from the time that I reached the age of reason, for if I had understood it then, I might have been able to go around some of the hurdles I have been forced to jump as I walked through the valley of the shadow of life. The story of my interview with the devil is now in your hands. The benefits you will receive from it will be in exact proportion to the thought it inspires in you. To benefit from listening to the interview, you need not agree with every portion of it. You have only to think and to reach your own conclusions concerning every part of it. How reasonable that is! You are the judge and the jury and the attorney for both the prosecution and the defense. If you do not win your case, the loss and the cause thereof will be yours.
One's dominating desires can be crystallized into their physical equivalents through definiteness of purpose, backed by definiteness of plans, with the aid of nature's law of hypnotic rhythm and time. Napoleon Hill wanted to share this message with the world in the 1930s, but instead it was hidden away in a vault, to be finally uncovered and shared with you now in 2011, for a reason. Will you realize you are carrying in your own pockets the matches with which the fires of adversity are being touched off, and find, too, that the water with which those fires can be finally extinguished is at your own command in great abundance? And then find your definiteness of purpose, create a definite plan, engage the aid of nature's law of hypnotic rhythm, and use the asset of time to assist you in reaching your greatest success.
Afterword by Michael Bernard Beckwith. Whether you have listened to this entire book or only a few of its pages before turning to this afterword, you will have realized that if the historical names, dates, and events in this book were replaced by those of our current times, little has changed. From Hill's description of media propaganda, the conditioning the children receive in school, the fear-based teachings preached by religions, people's poor diet and health habits, to the challenging economic climate, little seems to have shifted in our collective consciousness, and therefore, in our collective experience. The good news is that it is never too late for a new beginning, for a renaissance in consciousness. As Mr. Hill reminds us, I have also discovered that there comes with every experience of temporary defeat, and every failure and every form of adversity, the seed of an equivalent benefit. Our path is seemingly composed of a polarity of both failure and success. A lighter way of putting it might be that Hill's principles for living teach us how to fail successfully. This is a paradox understood by the spiritually mature, those whom he describes as having risen above the hypnotic rhythm and discovered their other self, which can also be identified as the self of the self, the higher self, or the authentic self. It is encouraging that many of today's spiritual, philosophical, self-help, and even scientific authors share Hill's view of what he calls definiteness of purpose, or in current parlance, intention setting. When it is our intention to wake up from the hypnotic rhythm of living, what the Hindus call delusion and the Buddhists call illusion, individual and collective consciousness expands. We, along with our global family, benefit. Hill's integrity shines through his description of what it means to manifest success. In fact, he unhesitatingly announces that any man can avail himself of the benefits of his other self, as long as he is not steeped in greed. This spiritually dignified statement elevates success to a matter of consciousness. That is, success does not necessarily mean that he who has the most toys wins. Hill thus eliminates confusing spiritual awakening with the capacity to manifest things in one's life, for there is never enough of more. We are also taught the importance of awareness, of mindfulness, an activity of consciousness abhorred by Hill's devil, who delights in using people's lack of thinking for themselves to his advantage. Consciously observing the mind and its capacities is to look at it with respect, compassion, gratitude, for it is God's gift to us. Mind not only forms our inner landscape, it creates our outer circumstances. Let us not fight with the mind. Let us appreciate its nuances, its intuitions, its utmost capacities, with the understanding that mind is the key to being self-directed, self-empowered, self-confident. Next to drifting, the most dangerous human trait Hill describes is the lack of caution, or what we might call a lack of discernment. Discernment is a relative of wisdom which causes us to think of the repercussions before we take action, as well as to honestly observe the results of our choice-making. Thus, we may create our own path to freedom. Hill's teachings are most often associated in the minds of his modern-day readers with prosperity, which translates as money in one's individual coffers. But truth be told, he has shared with the world his wisdom of how to live principles, beginning with one's interior being, one's inner state of consciousness, inviting us to give outer expression to our highest potential, not only for our own benefit, but for all humankind. I wish to add that it was a wisdom-guided choice on the part of the Napoleon Hill Foundation to entrust this precious manuscript to the able hands of Sharon Lecter. Her many years of deeply studying Napoleon Hill's truth principles, and more importantly, her practice of them, has made her a perfect candidate to now offer this manuscript to the world. May all Hill's readers break free from conditional belief systems and live life in all of its richness, its exquisite beauty and joy, freely delivering their gifts, talents, and skills on this planet we call home. Peace and richest blessings to you. Michael Bernard Beckwith. Michael Bernard Beckwith is the author of Spiritual Liberation, Fulfilling Your Soul's Potential.
Throughout Napoleon Hill's writings, there is a strong spirituality present, informing his methods and his morality. In many places in the present book, Outwitting the Devil, this religious foundation for his belief system is perhaps at its most explicit. Some of his statements about evil and fear, about indefiniteness and drifting, derive from an American religious tradition that dates back at least to the transcendentalism of Ralph Waldo Emerson in the mid-19th century. Currents in American spirituality in Hill's day during the writing of this book in the late 1930s included Norman Vincent Peale, Emmett Fox, and in popular inspirational fiction, Lloyd C. Douglas. The very personal Christian evangelism of Amy Simple McPherson and Billy Sunday were also still omnipresent in the media and public consciousness of the era. For Hill, however, the stature of some of the titans of industry and finance of the time achieved a kind of religious validation and served to inspire his own thought and action, and he urged others to look at these men, and all were men, as models of successful moral behavior that yielded personal success as well as general good. The Great Depression was for Napoleon Hill, in great measure, a moral failure. What would he say about our current crises in financial markets? The near collapse of the banking system in 2008, and the subsequent severe recession that has affected the lives of everyone who will pick up this book in 2011 and beyond? His pantheon included Carnegie, of course, Edison, Ford, and Rockefeller. Each of these tycoons has been subsequently analyzed and reanalyzed by historians, economists, and biographers, and their personal flaws placed in the glare of public scrutiny. To Hill, they were not historical figures, but contemporary leaders on the world stage, as were Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill. He did not critique Rockefeller's ruthless competitiveness, and he was probably unaware at the time of Ford's vitriolic anti-Semitism. For Hill, American society and the free market system held the best hope for the world as it teetered on the brink of conflagration, and even with the evident imperfections of his native country, what he saw as a susceptibility to the devil's machinations, there was nothing on earth that could compare to it. For individuals who made the personal choice to succeed in life, who resisted the temptations and the weaknesses of irreligion and sought instead the help of God, called by various names in the book, there was no limit to how far they might go. Limits were self-imposed or imposed by the negative outside force of evil, personified by the devil. So what is Hill's religion? Frankly, that's not important to me. As much as I have been influenced by Napoleon Hill's philosophy and fascinated by his life, it has never mattered to me what church he attended or whether he attended any church at all. More important is the question, what is he teaching us today about the role of faith in our lives? The answer to that question is for you to decide. I think it is a foundational issue that affects every line he writes. After all, he chose to frame this book in the classical genre of the philosophical dialogue, and he sets up a sparring match with the most vivid anti-religious figure in all of literature, from the Bible through Milton through C.S. Lewis. And I continue to be fascinated by this choice, for it allows Hill to express in a very readable style his own deeply held beliefs and theories about human behavior. It holds profound lessons for us all. As you go forward in your life and find obstacles in your way, it may serve you to review Hill's 7 principles for outwitting the devil in your life. 1. Definiteness of purpose. 2. Mastery over self. 3. Learning from adversity. 4. Controlling environmental influence, associations. 5. Time, giving permanency to positive rather than negative thought habits and developing wisdom. 6. Harmony, acting with definiteness of purpose to become the dominating influence in your own mental, spiritual, and physical environment. 7. Caution, thinking through your plan before you act. In reviewing these 7 principles, you may identify and reveal what is holding you back from achieving your greatest success. It was a profound blessing to me to have the Napoleon Hill Foundation entrust this manuscript to my hands, a manuscript that was hidden and locked away for over 70 years, either by his wife or the devil himself. You decide. They say when a student is ready, the teacher will appear. Is it possible that Think and Grow Rich was the right message during the Great Depression, and that outwitting the devil is the right message for our current times? I believe we see God's hand at work, not the devil's. I believe Outwitting the Devil was not published until God felt it was the right message at the right time, now for us in 2011. It has definitely made a huge impact in my life, and I hope that you will find value in it for your life. May Napoleon Hill's words bring you hope, courage, and most of all, definiteness of purpose for your life. Be blessed. Sharon Lecter.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Napoleon Hill's Outwitting the Devil, The Secret to Freedom and Success, by Napoleon Hill, edited and annotated by Sharon Lecter. Copyright 2011 by the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Performed by Dan John Miller and Phil Giganti. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Brandon Redeker. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.